For the past century, the dominant economic paradigm has painted a narrow and mechanic view of how capitalism works, focusing on the role of markets. The story is familiar. Rational, self-interested firms maximize profits, and rational, self-interested consumers maximize their utility. How does digitalization change the model of the homo economicus?
So, of course, economics always try to portray itself as a neutral, mathematical, allocative physics-like science, when in fact you can see, ideally, when you look back behind with a little bit of a hindsight, you can see how much ideology there is in economics. So, of course, the picture, the story, the fairy tale, the explanation, the theory, whatever you want to call it, that it shapes and structures the way people actually behave. This is something that sociologists know as Thomas' theorem. this has been described decades ago. Whatever is defined as real can be or will be real also in its consequences. Now, let's give a simple example. In the classical view of business, is the view that the business of breweries is to sell beer, right? That's so intuitive and so easy, we don't even talk about it. But if you think about it a little bit differently, isn't really the business of breweries harvesting beer culture? Because without beer culture, you would not be able to sell a single pint of beer. So the moment you start looking at your business as, okay, there is this common field called beer culture, which is very strong in Germany and also very strong in Czech Republic. So we can harvest this beer culture. But we also realize that we as entrepreneurs who harvest the beer culture field, we also have to make sure that the field gets cultivated. So from that perspective, small little change, and you can see how economics can become much less autistic, much less sort of casualistic. So the picture of the world is changing, especially with digitalization, because the basic premise of economics is that it's an area that researches scarcity. Now, in the internet digital age, scarcity will in many, many areas no longer exist. I mean, we all have these portals, these time space warp black holes or wormholes in our pockets, and they're called, you know, of course, the digital cell phone. You can transport yourself from here to China immediately with your attention. You can hear the whole world. You can speak to the whole world. Time and space collapses. And also your smartphone, if you've noticed, is bigger inside than on the outside. You can put 10 books or million books or 10 pictures or million pictures, and it all fits in. It's one of those magic bags that we've heard about in fairy tales when we were young, where you can put in infinite amount of things. So suddenly, of course, the whole logic of economics will change, because there are certain things in our daily experience which defy the logic of economics. For example, by using something more, it becomes more valuable, and you cannot really use it privately. For example, money. Money is an example of something that makes only sense in a relationship, in an exchange. If I had my own currency, that's really not good for anything. It's like having my own language. Language also works. The more people speak the language, the more precious it is. And internet and digitalization is also one of those things. The more people use the internet, the more people use a car, the less the car has of value. The more people use internet, the more internet has of value. So some of the most basic ideologies or some basic understandings with which we are entering the world are changing, and it's easy to see how it's really not a science but rather an ideology.
So you just explained economics with beer. Do you have another metaphor for the Silicon Valley capitalism of brands like or firms like Uber or Airbnb, which is driven by a radical libertarian vision of human empowerment through technology?
You know, I think if Plato would live today, he would be really, really excited and really happy because he would see some of his theories come to practice. He always believed, and he also gave this sort of into the heritage of our culture, that the mind transcends. He always believed, and he also gave it as an inheritance for our development of our culture, that mind overpowers the matter. And this is, in fact, what you can see if you put your GDP, let's imagine German GDP, if you put that on scales. If you weigh your GDP, you will discover that it's actually lighter and lighter, meaning more and more parts of GDP become something that's non-tangible, that you can't really knock on. And now just imagine all the things that we used before cell phones were invented, you know, recorder, speaker, tape player, CD disc, camera, I don't know, you know, 20 or perhaps even 30 things that we used to have in a material form, and now we have them in weightless digital form. So you can see this may be a nice example to understand what's happening is, for example, take communication. 100 years ago, or maybe even 50 years ago, or 20 years ago, let's say 80% of communication happened between two, three people. People didn't need the market to communicate with each other. Today, I would say 80% of our communication is given to the market. 80% of the communication is no longer me and you talking in the same room, but just like now, talking with each other at a distance. So we have learned how to sell or give out one intimate thing that we have, which was called communication. Now, if I want to talk with my mother, I will most often call her or send her a text message. And by every single call, I am employing hundreds and perhaps even thousands of people, cleaning lady, lawyers, marketing agencies, technicians, service people, accounting and advisory companies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in order to make that phone call. So what's happened is that, and this is something that Marshall said some decades ago, that when you learn to do it the Silicon way, the Silicon Valley way, when you are deprived of that extra Übermensch capacity of a human being to be basically able to do telepathy with the whole world, because that's what we've learned, we can now do telepathy with people in in China or people in Denmark. This is something that we always thought we will achieve as mankind using some spiritual ways and spiritual tactics. This is something that monks studied, but they were never so successful as this very technical approach. But anyway, back to economics. So what happened is that we have given away the function of communication, and communication has become telecommunication. So it has become part of the market. So a huge advantage of that is, of course, that I can have this telepathy with the whole world for almost no cost. Another example is that it shows in your GDP. So suddenly communication becomes a huge part of GDP, and it also becomes a huge, let's say, pooler of GDP. But we can no longer communicate without the market. So if the market of communication went down, I would feel speechless and I would feel earless and eyeless if you would deprive me of access to internet. I would literally feel like I am without my ears, my eyes, and my mouth. It's a little bit like with a car. Cars are an extension of our legs. Thanks to cars, we can run or transport ourselves much faster and over much larger distances than any animal has ever been able to do, except perhaps maybe dragons, but they've never been really fully confirmed. But what is the problem with cars? That if I banned you to use cars or public transport or any usage of wheel, you would feel as if legless. Of course, your biological legs would be there, two of them. You still can walk, but without a car, you would feel unable to move. You would probably not be even able to find a job in these days. So what I am saying is that by giving certain things to the internet, we enhance them. We become this transhuman, or perhaps even in the Nietzschean tradition, this Übermensch who can do miracles by any standards of the past, but is unable to live without it. So we are now dependent on the market to communicate. Now the question is, what can we do next? Well, for example, something that we could do is cooking. Also, you know, a couple of years, 10 years back, it was an intimate thing. Most people cooked at home and they didn't charge each other for cooking. So you didn't see it in GDP. Now more and more people go to restaurants or they order food. So suddenly, again, that thing of making food has become something of which is no longer your property, but it is a property of the market and you pay for it. And we do this willingly. Now the question is, will this happen with the raising of children? Will this happen with cleaning? Will this happen with, I don't know, sex? Will this happen with friendship? Will they be subsidized and will they be substituted by professional psychiatrists or psychologists or professional friends perhaps? That's another thing that you can nicely see in Facebook, that you are now able to have hundreds and thousands of friends, which would be technically impossible 10 years ago, but you no longer write letters. I remember when I was young, we really used to write letters with friends. I would even use email, but I would write a letter. I would like write a long one.
We are talking about developments like all of the time and how technology is evolving. And what is happening is that we're growing, actually, or that the economy is growing. Do we have something like a growth trap in digital markets? Because they have a nearly religious belief that growth is everything?
It's not sort of a religion, it is a religion. Just imagine if we took that belief in the future growth away from our thinking, our minds would almost collapse, the system would not be able to function. We need this strictly religious faith that tomorrow will be better than today, which is, by the way, quite a novelty. You don't see this in older and other religions than let's say Judeo-Christian tradition. Now, to me, computer program or a digital application I view it as the most modern form of mythology. We are, of course, fully aware that it is a virtual world. Even the voice that you hear is virtual. It, of course, sounds like I'm speaking with you, but I'm really speaking into a microphone. It sounds like I'm talking with my mother, but I'm not talking with my mother. I'm talking with a piece of digital equipment. So we do talk to machines. We also swear at machines, but that's a different topic. So this modern form of mythology, of course, resembles almost all the propensity. So this modern form of digital mythology, when you're playing a computer game, when you're watching a movie, when you are reading the newspapers, whatever you are doing, you are entering a non-world. It's a fictional, non-existing world. Of course, the internet doesn't weigh anything, and there is nothing real on the internet. And you can nicely see the fear, the mythological fear, which you can see in all religions. God or gods create lesser form of intelligence and lesser form of cognition, human beings. And the moment these human beings are created, they become threat to gods. And this is the similar feeling that we have, this fear of technologies, and you can see this nicely in pretty much all the modern science fiction movies. Let's take Matrix as an example, that we've created some sort of cognitive intelligence that will overpower us and eventually endanger us. And this fear of your own creation is something that God or gods must have felt too, because the moment they've created human beings, there was a problem.
Right now you're talking about machine overtaking humanity, but before that, maybe there are even other humans profiting from this kind of digital economics. And I'd want to ask, like you tell it, everyone profits from that. Everyone is in digital Übermensch, but is that really the case? Or makes this Silicon Valley capitalism some of us not so equal, or like threatens us or our economic life?
This is, of course, something that we are only beginning to realize. First of all, human beings already are in the abstract. It is not that the machines will overtake us somewhere in the future. I would say that 30-40% of an average person is already 40-60% in the cloud. All your memories are there, all your pictures, all your contacts, your schedules. We really literally are being uploaded, let's say, into the cloud more and more. I always like to connect this with old religious ideas of how heaven will look like, because it is also called cloud. So, you know, in a way, this is an entertaining thought experiment if the listeners have a free evening, just to try to connect the old age prophecies about how heaven will look like with our new ideas of this digital habitat that we are entering into. I believe that we, this generation, lives in a great movement of nations, not the one that we see geographically in Europe and in the Middle East or the Near East, but it is a movement of nations into the digital, from this world into a digital world. So I think, of course, reality will continue to exist, but we will no longer have our habitat in the real world. We will still need our basic biological needs, but we will treat, I think, in some decades, we will visit reality like today we are visiting a forest. You do it once, twice, maybe three times a year for aesthetic reasons or for health reasons, or I don't know. People simply like to go to the forest, but not more than a couple of days. Humanity no longer lives in the forest. Forest has become something that we need to, in fact, protect. Now, you asked about the economic implications of this. Well, this could lead, if it's not done smartly, this could lead to an extreme gravitization of capital. Even in the real world, one can easily see how capital gravitates towards capital. I mean, the one who has is more likely to have more, and the one who has little is disadvantaged. Now, let's imagine that we invent artificial intelligence. Let's say that we create an algorithm, a computer program that can diagnose you and solve your illness better than a doctor. So this is one program, and you only needed once, and it has to be living on the internet. Who will own this? Who will own the algorithm? Is that something that one person can own, or is that a property, healing in this case, is that a property of mankind in general? Now, the Uber example you gave, or Airbnb, this is something that's extremely fascinating. It's nothing more than an algorithm. So Uber has higher value than many car producing companies such as, I don't know, General Motors or Ford, but Uber does not own a single car. And the similar story goes with Airbnb. Their market capitalization or their market value is comparable to huge hotel chains all around the world, such as, I don't know, Hilton or Marriott. And yet, Airbnb owner doesn't own a single flat. So it's just an idea that brings this amount of money. And in these two examples, it's not such a big thing. These algorithms are privately owned, and the gravity of capital is also huge in this case, and it has extremely disruptive and positive effects on taxis and on hotels. But I think we really need to sit down as mankind and decide how will, because we are used to taxing labor, and when human beings will no longer labor, then how do we tax the machines? How do we tax the algorithm? So this will be definitely something that will go under heavy debate in the upcoming years.
What Uber and Airbnb, for example, are doing is they measure things, or their algorithm is based on a measurement because they want to like make our lives better and they can measure something. And there is this journalist, Marco Maas, and he said, only what can be measured can be made better. Do you believe in that too? Data processing is becoming a key means by which our society, economy and social lives are being shaped. Can big data predict and change human behavior?
It's not true that what you cannot measure, you cannot improve. This I think works in some places, but especially when it comes to more human type of qualities. Those it's hard to measure. And this is exactly the trick of a human being. Again, going back to my favorite topic of mythology and combining old mythology with new mythology, we human beings always feared two things. One is regress to an animal state. That is the topic of most of horrors. Do realize that most of the scary things that jump at you from your horror movies are a combination of human being with an animal, be it a werewolf or a witch or a vampire or a madman or a child. These are all not fully rational beings. They are human beings, but they have these animalistic, uncontrolled, irrational cravings which attack the healthy individuals. So that's something that we've been fearing. But the other fear that we have is the fear of robots, the fear that we will become robots, the fear that we will have no longer emotions and that we will be exactly only doing things that you can calculate. You know, of course, you love a person or you have joy and that can go up and down and you can't really, really calculate that. And a relationship can get worse and it can get better without really having any numbers in it. And that's exactly the scary thing. The scary thing is that we will put everything into numbers and that we will treat each other on strictly rational basis. Now, this is the topic of George Orwell's 1984. This is the topic of this new movie that's being aired in the theaters called The Lobster. So human beings fear animals, so emotional beings without developed rationality on one hand, and on the other hand, we feel excess rationality of mathematical nature, being too cold. And the place for a human being is in between a robot, rational, calculating, optimizing in unit, between that and between an animal. And there is no psychological peace there. Human beings will always be tossed once attracted to sins of emotion. This is what we always say. Sorry, I was too emotional. I wasn't thinking. But we forget, and this is my final sentence, we forget that there are very many sins of rationality. Not only sins of emotion, I did something out of emotion, but I think the most hideous crimes that mankind has ever committed were sins of rationality. In other words, we act rationally without emotions.
Thank you very much.